But good morning and welcome to another of what have turned out to be very popular Greens List breakfast topics. Today, of course, is in respect to the new Juries Act directions, which we are all subject to. And as you'll hear from our presenters, the Juries Directions Act 2013 came into force on the first day of July last. The Act begins a complete overhaul of the law governing jury directions in criminal trials in Victoria and provides a new framework within which jury directions in criminal trials will be given. The reason it appears for this is because it was thought that jury directions in Victoria had become increasingly complex, long and unnecessarily so, and unhelpful to jurors. And I wonder if that juror who fell asleep before Justice Priest thought that too. The new Act simply sets out to simplify the task and the issues for the jury and clarify the duties of trial judges and legal practitioners in formulating the jury directions that will be given. In addition, as you'll be aware, the Act provides for a trial judge to answer questions from a jury about the meaning of the phrase beyond reasonable doubt and provides simplified directions to the jury as to post-offence conduct by an accused. The Act's fairly short, and can I suggest that all of you who clearly have an interest in this area simply buy a copy of it or print it off and read it. This morning's program will be, we have three presenters, each will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we will have a panel discussion led by myself where I'll ask a few questions and you too may ask the panel questions as well. The first presenter will be Sarah Keating, and her topic will be the reasons for this change. Sarah will be known to many of you. She came to the bar in 2008, having perhaps the rare distinction of being Justice Curtin's associate both in the County Court and in the Supreme Court. She is eagerly sought after as junior counsel, and her CV is more impressive than mine after 5 years, but you can read about that on the website. But she's developing already quite an experience in criminal trials. So she'll be the first presenter and she will be speaking about reasons for the change. Following Sarah, Theo Alexander will address you. Theo came to the bar in May of 2003, so he's been here for about 10 years. His practice is primarily in criminal law and quasi-criminal proceedings in both state and Commonwealth jurisdictions, specialising, I think, in white-collar type offences under the Crimes Act, Commonwealth Criminal Code and Corporations Act and Tax Act offences. Theo also lectures in undergraduate and postgraduate programs at Deakin University in corporate crime and international commercial law, ethics and privilege, and the law of evidence. And Theo's subject this morning will be to tell us precisely what the changes are that are implemented by the Act. Following Theo will be Charles Morgan, who will tell us how the changes will affect us as practitioners. Charles also has been at the bar approximately 10 years, having signed the bar roll in November of 2005, has developed a fairly extensive circuit trial practice through country Victoria, and has appeared in many criminal trials for accused persons in both the Supreme Court and county courts, both in Melbourne and on circuit. So they are our speakers, they are the topics, and perhaps if we could welcome Sarah Keating, who will tell us the reasons for the change.
Well, as has just been pointed out to you, the Act came into effect this year on the 1st of July. It's the result of work undertaken by the Victorian Law Reform Commission, the Jury Directions Advisory Group, the Judicial College of Victoria, and at the instigation of the Chief Justice and President of the Court of Appeal, a team headed by Justice Weinberg. So why the change? Well, juries can't understand directions. In May 2009, the VLRC published a report entitled Jury Directions. In preparing it, the VLRC was assisted by trial and appellate judges, Crown prosecutors and barristers. The VLRC was asked by the Attorney General to review the law and practice concerning the directions which judges give to juries in criminal trials and to recommend changes for improvement. The VLRC was requested to have regard to the overall aims of the criminal justice system, including prompt and efficient resolution of criminal trials and procedural fairness for accused people. The report encapsulates the state of jury directions given in Victoria at that time in these terms. The state of the law of jury directions is conducive of judicial error. Trial judges often face problems in determining when to give directions and in formulating the content of directions. Errors in jury directions have resulted in many retrials being ordered on appeal. The complexity of jury directions does not assist effective communication with juries. The concern about the law on jury directions and impact the law has on juries, trials and the criminal justice system generally has been echoed in judicial comment. Post-dating the VLRC report, the President in Wilson and the Queen put the concern succinctly. He said if the Victorian community is to continue to have confidence in the operation of jury trials, there needs to be legislative intervention to simplify the directions which judges are required to give. His Honour noted in the context of sexual offending, the law governing the trial of sexual offences is now so extraordinarily complex as to throw into doubt the expectations on which the system of trial by jury is founded. Those expectations are first, that a trial judge can reasonably be expected to explain the relevant law to the jury in all its permutations and combinations, without falling into error, and secondly, that the jury can reasonably be expected not only to comprehend the law as so explained, but to apply it to the evidence which they've heard. The concern is again supported by empirical studies aimed at measuring jury comprehension. Ogloff and Rose concluded in 2005 that jurors appear largely incapable of understanding judicial instructions as they're traditionally delivered by the judge. The overwhelming weight of the evidence is that jury instructions are not understood and therefore cannot be helpful. This is an extremely troubling finding, you might think. An example of a jury direction from a 2006 case demonstrates the point. If you are satisfied that one or more of the accused killed the deceased, but you are not satisfied that the Crown has not proved beyond reasonable doubt that the accused did not act in self-defence, he is not guilty of either murder or manslaughter. And you might share the view that this direction's largely unintelligible. It's this type of complex direction which the Jury Act seeks to clarify. Research relied on by the JDAG in preparation of its report shows that complex directions have the effect of confusing jurors, which may lead jurors to not apply the direction or apply it wrongly, could lead to disengagement with the decision-making process and therefore affect the integrity of the process, more likely to contain errors resulting in possible appeals and retrials, and take a long time and therefore contribute to court delays. The cause of the problem in jury directions. Well, the efforts of the VLRC and the JDAG identified a number of deficiencies that have resulted in burdensome directions for juries. The complexity of the evolving law is one, the Pemble obligation is another. It requires trial judges to direct the jury about defences and alternative verdicts that were not raised by an accused during a trial, but are reasonably open on the evidence. Problems of efficiency arise in this regard because in order for judges to appeal proof their charges, courts have given directions that are technically rather than realistically necessary to the facts in issue. The obligation neither is responsive to an adversarial system where trial counsel makes forensic choices that are meant to bind the client in respect of which directions are requested, but then can later appeal the decision of judges who comply with the Pemble obligation in giving directions that were not sought or failing to give directions that were. This Act recalibrates and codifies the onus on both counsel and judge to identify the directions required, leaving only a residual discretion for judges to impose directions not otherwise requested, where it would amount to a substantial miscarriage of justice. Other problems are the lack of assistance from counsel provided to trial judges in determining which directions are required, also the lack of assistance from trial judges in appreciating necessary directions to apply, problems juries have had with interpretation of beyond reasonable doubt, and the complexity of directions in respect of post-defence conduct or consciousness of guilt. The Act identifies these deficiencies and proposes improvements to them. Part 1 concerns its purposes and captures each improvement. 1A is to reduce the complexity of jury directions in criminal trials. B, to simplify and clarify the issues that juries must determine in criminal trials. C, to simplify and clarify the duties of trial judge in giving jury directions in criminal trials. D, to clarify that it is one of the duties of legal practitioners appearing in criminal trials to assist the trial judge in deciding which jury directions should be given. E, to assist the trial judge to give jury directions in a manner that is clear, brief, simple, and comprehensible as possible. F, to permit the trial judge to answer questions from the jury about the meaning of the phrase proof beyond reasonable doubt. And G, to provide for simplified jury directions in relation to post-defence conduct. Changes that the Act brings about responsive to these issues include the introduction of integrated directions. So juries are no longer told what the law is, told what the facts are, and left to work out for themselves how to reconcile the two. The Act encourages the use of presenting directions in written form to assist comprehension, and it also encourages the use of factual questions for the jury which have embedded in them the legal framework in which they are to determine the issue. The Act also allows for a mandatory direction to be given in cases where the prosecution identifies at the outset an intention to rely on post-defence conduct. So the common law requirements from Edwards' case and Zonef's case are replaced with a focus on key questions. That is, when can the jury use post-defence conduct evidence? When must a direction be given by the trial judge in respect of it? What must the direction contain? And when must it be given to a jury to prevent it from using mistakenly as evidence of post-defence conduct? And that's contained in sections 22 to 28 of the new Act. The Act also provides for the reduction of necessary information that the judge has to summarise as part of his or her charge. In Victoria, the research shows that we have the world's longest charges. A comparison with other jurisdictions is instructive as to why change is necessary to preserve the integrity of criminal trials in an intelligible form for a jury. In 2006, a survey of judges in Australia and New Zealand found that the average length of a charge following a 10-day jury trial in Victoria was 255 minutes. For a 20-day trial, that figure increased to 349 minutes, or nearly 6 hours. By contrast, the average in New Zealand was 76 minutes for a 10-day trial and 108 minutes for a 20-day trial. And it took less than half the time to deliver a jury charge in Western Australia than in an equivalent case in Victoria. The Jury Directions Act addresses this aspect in Part 4. The evidence need not be wholly put back to a jury. In fact, it should not. The Act requires that only so much of the evidence as the trial judge considers necessary to assist the jury to determine the issues at trial need to be summarised. That's at section 17D. The same would apply in respect of counsel's addresses. In my view, this is a real advantage for defence. If you have, for example, a case where you've got allegations of sexual abuse, and those allegations are detailed and persuasive for that reason, and where you rely on inconsistencies in versions given of those events as part of your defence, you can seek to avoid the jury hearing a lengthy recitation of every aspect of the evidence, or a recitation of it that may not reflect the way in which you put your case, by ensuring that the judge complies with an obligation to summarise only the necessary aspects and do so briefly, because under the new Act, brevity is preferred. And in that way, the position you contend for in closing is more readily preserved, the jury having heard it in closer proximity to beginning their deliberations. So in conclusion, change here is similar with other changes recently introduced to the criminal jurisdiction. It's directed toward efficiencies, that is, the reduction of appeals. The same can be said of the interlocutory appeal process, which ensures that trials don't proceed erroneously where the rot can first be stopped. Shorter time frames for lodgement of appeal grounds means the retention of trial counsel so that matters not taken at trial can't get taken over the road. The Jury Directions Act 2 is aimed at reducing the instance of appeals by codifying the obligation of counsel in relation to jury directions and ensuring juries understand what they're told. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll now hear from Theo Alexander as to what precisely the changes are as implemented by the Act.
Thanks, Ian. In order to be consistent, not only do they talk about being brief, but they are being brief because that's the Act itself. It's actually something you could even print yourself because it's only 25 pages long. So there is a certain amount of consistency. The Act applies, as you heard, from 1st of July to all trials commenced after that date requiring compliance with its provisions. So as Sarah told you, the Act is really about simplifying and shortening judges' charges in criminal trials, and essentially this legislation really is directed to two groups of people, one, judges, and two, trial lawyers. It does set out really the statutory obligations now imposed on a judge in respect to directing a jury. Like Sarah said, observations about the length of jury directions have been made in respect to this, preparing for this Act, and I think it was Raina Tang, the Law Institute president, who said that in the US, on average, directions are 15 to 30 minutes. In Scotland, 15 to 18 minutes, and we heard in Victoria, 255 minutes on average. And in fact, the longest in Victoria went on for 21 days. Now, no one really likes change all that much. It just makes a lot of more work for us. But that being said, there probably is some role for a change in respect to jury directions in this case. So the key changes that you have to observe, we've probably heard about them, I'll repeat them because you don't actually want to do anything about this after you leave today. You want it in your head. So five things you need to remember. One, new set of guiding principles that judges need to take into account. It just talks about what the Act is designed to do when judges are considering the type of direction that they're going to give in a particular case. Two, there is now a directions request procedure. The directions request procedure is what we need to do when we're discharging our function as trial counsel. Three, integrated directions, essentially a desire on behalf of the legislature to stop separating out the obligations to summarise evidence, talk about law, and leave that to the jury, but rather telling the jury and synthesising for the jury how the law would apply in the particular case. And in fact, in my view, that makes good sense. Four, yes, new guidance on beyond reasonable doubt. A judge previously really shouldn't say anything about beyond reasonable doubt and say to the jury the words are what they mean. Now the jury is actually going to be informed by a judge within some ambit about what that actually means. And fifthly, this is an interesting part. It's about consciousness of guilt, which is now called post-defence conduct. What's interesting is they've chosen to include this particular section in this Act, in this first version of the Act, But Justice Weinberg, who undertook the review in respect to this, had recommended in his report that there be further inclusions about complicity, about inferences and circumstantial evidence, and thank God, tendency and coincidence evidence, and unreliable evidence. So they might also find a home in terms of what needs to be said or what should not be said in respect of those directions in the future. So looking at the Act now itself, it's divided into six operative provisions. There's a Seventh Amendment and transitional, we won't worry about that. So the six operative parts of the Act, one, preliminary matters, two, general matters, three, the request for directions, four, trial judges summing up, five, proof beyond reasonable doubt, six, post-defence conduct. How wonderfully simple. So let's look at each of those in turn. Part one, preliminary. In the first part, what it does is set out motherhood statements, effectively, like the purpose is to reduce the complexity of jury directions and clarify it is one of the duties of legal practitioners appearing in criminal trials to assist trial judges in deciding which direction should be given. Well, yes, okay, that's probably not new. Part two contains the guiding principles. Now, these statements are what the judges will take into account when they're deciding how to craft their charge and what directions they'll give. It says, importantly, at section 5 sub 4, directions must be confined to the issues and as clear, brief, simple and comprehensible as possible. Why legislate the obvious? Well, I suppose that the drafters thought that the judges were giving jurors too many directions in an attempt essentially to appeal-proof their directions. But ultimately, it was an unhelpful development. What the explanatory memorandum says is that the Act signifies a new approach to jury directions and is designed to effect cultural change. Quite a significant statement. So what you'd expect is to see a new focus on whether the directions sought by parties really are necessary. Moving on to part three, the process, request for directions. So the aim, as you've heard, is to abolish the Pemble rule that currently requires a judge to direct on any issue open on the evidence, even if it's not explicitly raised by the defence. Although I note that that obligation on the trial judge, irrespective of the party's views, is retained in the case of unrepresented litigants for obvious reasons. It's probably this request for directions process designed to remove judicial guesswork and really imposes upon the lawyers who are appearing in the case the obligation to make the call. What happens is immediately after the close of evidence, the defence are required to tell the jury exactly what the matters in issue are. Section 10 in respect to those matters in issue requires counsel to consider A, each element of the offence charged, B, any defence, C, any alternative offence, and D, any alternative basis for complicity. With those matters in issue in mind under Section 10, both parties then need to tell the judge what directions they want about those matters in issue or what they want the judge to direct the jury about in respect to the evidence relevant to the matters in issue. Now, once that process has been undertaken, it's then up to the judge to give directions that are requested, unless there are good reasons not to do so. That's section 14. The risk is, of course, if you don't ask for a direction, then firstly, the judge is not obliged to give it under section 13, and B, you really can't complain about its absence on appeal unless you can show that the absence of the direction has resulted in a substantial miscarriage of justice. And in that way, this, unless there's been a substantial miscarriage of justice, is a residual obligation on the judge to give a direction if he or she thinks it's necessary. And that ties in with the 276 appeal provisions under the Criminal Procedure Act. So the fallback position is if there's a risk of substantial miscarriage of justice, the judge will have to inform the parties first but then give that direction. There are exceptions, though, as to what defence counsel need to request of a judge. What he or she doesn't need to request are general directions, and I'll define general directions in a minute. The second matter that they don't need to request specifically are directions required by legislation, for example, some of the sex crime directions, and C, again, picking up, there's no need to give directions where the purpose is to avoid a substantial miscarriage of justice. So the important distinction here is between the specific directions that a judge would be asked for by in respect to the matters in issue and those that are general directions in a trial. And so the matters that you don't need to ask for, the general directions are, for example, then it's in the definition to the Act, roles of trial judge, jury and counsel, impanelment of jury and selection of a four-person trial procedure, issues about admissible evidence, deciding each charge separately, assessment of witnesses, the usual matters which are fundamental to the running of a trial. You don't need to ask for those. A judge will do it anyway. Part four, yeah, that's the process that we'll need to engage in. Part four now, moving to the new views about how a trial judge needs to sum up. So what we're talking about is integrated directions. And an integrated direction, for although it's a neat term, essentially really means applying the facts to the law in this case, and particularly the parties' cases. This part of the Act is directed squarely at trial judges. It's about telling them how to do their summing up. What an integrated direction will do is make directions shorter and easier for juries to understand, because it dispenses with the repetition of telling them a mini lecture on the law and then the facts in this case, and then inviting them to apply the facts, the law that they've been told about, to the facts in this case. In a sense, what it does is the judge does it for them now. That's how I interpret this process. And that must be an easier task for the jury to understand, and it must be a quicker process. Sections 17 and 18 restrict directions about law and evidence to only so much as is necessary for the jury to determine the issues in trial. A judgment call made by the judge, how appropriate. Trial judges no longer have to give comprehensive summaries about evidence and arguments. So don't expect to hear your words repeated back to the jury by the judge as often anymore, although there's no doubt that that may still be possible. But section 19 says that where law or evidence is addressed in an integrated charge, a judge doesn't have to repeat it elsewhere. So really, part four crystallises the benefits of integrated directions. And really, most trials, they're probably already used widely these days. But the difference is that they're often accompanied by the traditional summary of evidence, the elements of the offence and arguments of counsel. That won't happen anymore. Moving on to part five now. Proof beyond reasonable doubt. Well, common law, long-standing authority has said to judges, no, it's not appropriate for you to articulate to a jury the meaning of the phrase proof beyond reasonable doubt, Green and the Queen, 1971, Commonwealth Law Report decision. And in fact, in New South Wales, Justice Newman said, judges should not depart from the time-honoured formula that the words beyond reasonable doubt are words in the ordinary English usage and mean exactly what they say. Well, not anymore. In fact, although it's still an error, really, on the part of a judge to intrude upon a jury's function by voluntarily attempting to define it, if a jury seeks further assistance under Section 20, a judge can now say more than the words mean what they say. Section 21 sub 1 really does free the judges from those common law restrictions and says that the directions that a judge may give a jury might include the following phrases, quote, it is almost impossible to prove anything with absolute certainty when reconstructing past events, and the prosecution does not have to do so. A reasonable doubt is not an imaginary or fanciful doubt or an unrealistic possibility, and goes into a number of permutations. There's been some criticism because the Act adopted definitions from other jurisdictions, Canada, New Zealand and the UK, and in some of those directions that they modelled ours on, for example, in a case called Wanhela, it concludes that the direction says if you are not sure that the accused is guilty, you must find him or her not guilty. Now, we haven't included the bit about being sure, and there's been some criticism that juries might not understand that the burden is as high as it is on the prosecution with the way that the Act actually sets out the definition. So there is a risk potentially under the way it's been defined under the Act that a judge can treat the question of proof beyond reasonable doubt that they may not equate it with the very strict test that it imposes, because it doesn't talk about you need to be sure, which the other jurisdictions do. So on that basis, there may be some indeed scope for appeal yet in respect to those directions. Lastly, looking at post-offence conduct. Now, post-offence conduct, what was consciousness of guilt, like some of the aspects of the Evidence Act where notice, tendency notices, for example, coincidence notices need to be given before prosecution seek to rely on certain conduct, indeed now post-offence conduct, before that can be relied upon, there needs to be a notice, section 23. The test for admission and use of incriminating conduct, that is this consciousness of guilt evidence, remains unchanged. Under section 24, trial judge must first determine use of the incriminating conduct, if it's reasonably open, having regard to the evidence. But there are two important changes in respect to this area of the law. First is that the trial judge is no longer required to give any warning about incriminating conduct unless requested by defence or required to avoid that substantial miscarriage of justice. For example, a warning that there are all sorts of reasons why a person may lie other than guilt of the charges is no longer required unless requested or compelled. The common law requirement that warnings such as this be given despite the wishes of defence is abolished by section 28. Potentially beneficial to the accused because it might prevent the jury engaging in a line of reasoning which they otherwise wouldn't have engaged in but for the judge alerting them to that fact. Second change is removal by section 25 sub 2 of the current requirement that a trial judge specify each act or omission covered by the post-offence conduct directions. So in terms of the future, as I say, expect to see the inclusion after post-offence conduct of subheadings of complicity, of inferences and circumstantial evidence, of tendency and coincidence, where the Act then sets out what a judge should say and shouldn't say in respect to those types of directions. And those recommendations, if you're interested, are in the report written by Justice Weinberg. That's my part.
Thank you, Theo. I'll now invite Charles Morgan to tell us what is really dear to most of our hearts, what we as practitioners are now expected to do as a result of the changes to the Act. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. Thanks, Ian. Good morning, everybody. The hazard, of course, of being last of three is that I'll inevitably repeat some of the things you've already heard, but as Theo said, some of the changes that this Act attempts to bring about are probably more significant than at first blush. Certainly when I first had a read of this Act, I thought, well, this is just formalising what is already going on in many courts. That is a discussion between the bench and the practitioners about what's actually an issue and formulating the charge to suit that. But on closer look at the Act, there is actually a real seismic shift that's aimed at criminal trials that's important to focus on. Now, my role was to address the effect on practitioners of the Act, and while the Act is directed overtly to defence counsel in many cases and trial counsel generally, it affects practitioners, both solicitors and counsel, equally, because criminal solicitors have that continuity with client from the day they walk in the door to judgment that trial counsel might not have. And hopefully, by what I say next, you'll realise why that's much more important now. You've heard that the Act is dear to Justice Weinberg's heart, and he referred to the great change in this Act as reverting to the adversarial system, right? So, implying that we'd gone away from it and saying this Act reverts to it. And what he means by that, I think, and quite clearly by the Act, is he's now saying the onus of formulating the case and putting it to a jury at the end of the case is fairly and squarely on us, the practitioners, and being moved away from the trial judge. And that's because it's thought, and probably rightly, that the practitioners are the best place to think about what the case is about and think about how best to direct the jury in that case. Basically, that the judge should be guided by the practitioners as to what the case is really about rather than the other way around, which can happen. Now, What that means is now, as I've said, the onus is on us to nail our colours to the mast early and clearly, and we will be held to account, and our client will be ultimately, by that those decisions that are made during the running of the trial. Now, and I think crucially, that's going to affect us when you make forensic decisions about what alternate offences will be left to the jury and what available defences will be left to the jury. And that's dealt with by what Theo referred to in as the direction request procedure, which is found in part three, and I'll focus on that solely, I think, for the purpose of how it's going to affect us. What it will mean is it's the end of an attitude that apparently exists, that at the end of the evidence and at the end of closing, there's a practitioner attitude of, well, the rest is a matter for Your Honour. You do the law, we do the facts. That's at an end. Now, you'll be required under the Act to put fairly and squarely what you say the case is about. It's also been put this way, that it's a shift of considering the appropriate directions away from the appellate stage of a trial and back to the first instance stage. Now, Theo went through the sections of the Act. As I've said, the most important section for us as practitioners are sections 10 and 16. And that's what was also referred to as the abolition of the Pemble direction. That was said to be the proposition that the judge must direct the jury on all defences available and all alternate verdicts, even if not raised by the accused at any stage. Now the obligation, as I said, is for counsel, defence counsel only, under section 10, at the close of evidence, to tell the judge what's an issue clearly, and to nominate what alternate offences you want left to the jury and what defences you want left to the jury. If you make the choice and you're stuck with it. We have to be aware now the chance of appeal, as Theo raised, mentioned, sitting back and watching the judge try and appeal proof the decision by observing the obligation that used to exist under Pemble, and then appealing on the basis that either he went too far, he or she went too far, or left something out. If things go bad, that's gone. Now, what that will mean, I think practically for practitioners, is that the client will have to be drawn into this more and more. I mean, it may be that you make a forensic decision to leave out an alternate offence, say your client's charged with intentionally caused serious injury. The alternate offence is obviously of recklessly caused serious injury or just a straight injury charge. You might make a forensic decision to leave them out to avoid any chance of a compromised verdict. You will now need to make that decision and make it clear if you're ready to argue it before a judge, and then you are stuck with that decision. The judge no longer has the obligation to leave to the jury those alternates. Now, and that has obvious ramifications for the defence counsel particularly. Now, section 14, of course, if you've read the Act, leaves open the possibility that the judge won't give a direction if asked for, and might give a direction even if it's not asked for in certain circumstances. So you have to be aware of that possibility and ready to argue your point prior to the charge, the judge charging the jury. Section 11 in part 3 That's the section Theo mentioned as well, where the obligation now is on both counsel after the defence has nailed their colours to the mast in respect of what exactly is in issue and the alternate offences and possible defences they want left to the jury. Both prosecution and defence then need to go into and request, or specifically ask to be excluded, other directions on the evidence and the matters raised in trial. Now, this is important too for practitioners because there were certain directions that you would expect would automatically be given at the end of a trial in certain circumstances. For instance, when your client chooses not to give evidence at the trial, you would almost invariably, the judge would ask you or would tell you that he was going to give the as a party direction, that is the direction that invites, in general terms, invites the jury not to draw any adverse inference from the fact that your client has chosen not to give evidence. Now, under these new rules, if you don't ask for that, you won't get it. Simple as that. As Theo mentioned, under Section 15, there are some catch-all provisions where the judge might suspect you either incompetence or having some very high-risk strategy and not asking for that, and can then invite submissions on that issue. But in general terms, if you don't ask for it, you won't get it. And it's very important to be aware of that. And so I think practically what will need to happen with defence counsel and probably in conjunction with the prosecutor is, and I think it will happen, that a standard form checklist will be developed that will be, whether it's in tick box form or some other form, that will be used in just about every trial to make sure that you have not omitted something that is important to your client in ensuring that he or she has a fair trial. The flip side of that obligation is that, in fact, another aspect of that obligation is it might actually work in favour of your client. It might be that there are very good reasons for not wanting, say, the as a party direction, using that example. It might be that your client has given a very good record of interview, set out almost in textbook form the law on self-defence, for instance, in the record of interview. And you might not want it highlighted to the jury that there's another way that your client may have given that evidence. You might just want it contained to the record of interview, rely on it, and nothing more said to the jury. So in that sense, the new obligations under Section 11 might in some circumstances work in favour of the accused, and then in that you can make that decision not to have that direction given, and the judge will respect that and will not be required in appeal proofing a decision, for instance, to give the direction in any event. Now, as I said, I don't want to go over what has already been said about the import of this Act, but just to highlight that the real focus and the real change that it brings is that change. The onus is back on us to, and most practitioners say they do this anyway, but the onus is there now in the Act to focus on the case, focus on what's in issue, and be ready to clearly articulate it at the close of evidence to the trial judge. Now, the benefit for that, of course, for the practitioners is we get to shape the trial in a way that maybe we haven't been able to in the past. And I think Sarah and Theo touched on this a little bit in respect of the other parts of this Act, which I won't go into in any great detail, that really relate to how the judge approaches the trial, that is, ability to give integrated directions, removing the requirement to summarise all the evidence and the closings. there'll be an opportunity, I think, for counsel to have an input in then what is the shape of the integrated directions, for instance? What do they look like? What is the evidence that will be highlighted in those integrated directions? And I think it'll be incumbent on us to make sure that we do get involved in that discussion with both the prosecutor and the trial judge prior to giving the charge to ensure that we get maximum benefit out of these changes, as well as observing our obligations under them, obviously with the interests of the, from a defence point of view, with the interests of the accused at heart at all times. I might, noting the time, leave it there. As Theo said, there are some interesting aspects of changes to what a judge can say in respect to beyond reasonable doubt. But if there are any questions about them, we might deal with them in the panel discussion. Thank you.